Okay, Ezra chapter 9. After these things had been done, the officials approached me and said, "The people of Israel and the priest and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the land with their abominations from the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has mixed itself with the peoples of the land. And in this faithlessness, the hand of the officials and chief men has been most foremost." During the interval between the rule of Zerubbabel and Ezra, who was sent by the Persian king to be governor in the province, you remember we've talked about this, some 57 years elapsed from the time they finally finished rebuilding the temple and the time of Ezra's coming to the land. So during this interval, it seems that the government had devolved upon a few of the princes and elders of the land, and they had kind of served as civil authorities, kept the peace and tranquility. They would judge in matters of that were criminal and civil, and but they were weak otherwise. And it seems that in regard to religious matters, in regard to the keeping of the law of Moses, it was just every man did as he thought in his own heart. So during this time, apparently, a number of problems developed. We're going to read about some others over in Nehemiah. But one of the problems that began to be noticed was the fact that these people had begun intermarrying with the peoples of the land. And you'll recall from the Old Testament that God had strictly forbade them marrying the people from the lands that they came in to conquer. And by implication, any other lands about that where the people were idolatrous. And so they had begun doing that here. Now, two interesting things, I think, about this. In verse 1, we're told that the officials approached me and said. Now, it doesn't mean that all the officials, because a little bit further down, we're going to learn that this same class of people were some of the ones that were guilty of this. But it's interesting to me that it wasn't the priest, it wasn't the ecclesiastical order that brought this to the attention of Ezra. It was the civil officials that brought it. And I think we'll learn why that's the case a little bit later on. And that is because the priests themselves were involved in this. Even some of the sons and nephews of Jeshua the high priest were involved in this intermarrying. And so they did not bring it to his attention because they were guilty of it themselves. But some of the officials did bring it to his attention. And in verse 2 it says, "For they have taken some of their daughters to be their wives, and in this faithlessness the hands of the officials and chief men have been foremost." So while some of the officials reported it to Ezra, some of the others were themselves involved in it. And we'll learn a little bit further down that even the priests, as I said a moment ago, were involved. So, verse 3, "As soon as I heard this, I tore my garment and my cloak and pulled the hair from my head and beard and sat appalled. Then all who trembled at the word of the God of Israel because of the faithlessness of the returned exiles gathered around me while I sat appalled until the evening sacrifice. And so Ezra's first reaction when he heard it was to just, well, as the scripture says, to be appalled. He sat, and you know, you read in the Old Testament about them sitting in sackcloth and ashes. He just pulled the hair from his beard and his hair, and it's hard for me to imagine that. And, yeah, ouch. And he sat just disturbed by it. And not only him, but others as well, who still had great reverence and respect for the law, gathered around him. And they sat that way until the time of the evening sacrifice. This was probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then he said in verse 5, at the evening sacrifice, I rose from my fasting with my garment and my cloak torn and fell upon my knees and spread out my hands to the Lord of God. I don't know this, but it may very well be that Ezra had in mind Solomon's prayer. You remember when he dedicated the temple and the long prayer of Solomon? This was before he had been influenced by these strange wives and had fallen from the great pedestal that upon which he began his work as king of Israel and one who feared God. But in this prayer, he said, when your people, wherever they are, realize their transgressions or see their need for you, and turn their face toward this place, Jerusalem and the temple, and pray to you, will you hear them? And so it may well be that Ezra had that very prayer of Solomon in mind. But that's what he did. At the evening sacrifice, he arose and fell on his knees and spread out his hands to the Lord, saying, oh my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads, and our guilt has mounted up to the heavens. From the days of our fathers to this day, we have been in great guilt, and our iniquities, we, our kings and our priests, have been given into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to plundering, and to utter shame, as it is today. So, because of our past sins, our nation was destroyed. We were taken into captivity, and to utter shame. And now, for a brief moment, favor has been shown by the Lord our God to leave us a remnant and to give us a secure hold. This is interesting, this expression, to give us a secure hold. I looked it up, and the original language there has reference to a tent peg, the peg that holds the corner of a tent. And so we're not a great nation anymore. We're nothing much more than just a peg that holds one of the colors. But he's given us a secure hold within this holy place that our God might brighten our eyes and grant us a little reviving in our slavery. They were still slaves. They were bond servants under the authority of the Persian nation and the Persian king. And he says, for we are slaves, yet our God has not forsaken us in our slavery, but has extended to us his steadfast love before the kings of Persia to grant us some reviving to set up the house of our God, to repair its ruins, and to give us protection in Judea and Jerusalem. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you commanded by your servants, the prophets, saying, the land that you are entering to take possession of it is a land impure, with the impurity of the peoples of the land, with their abominations that have filled it from end to end with their uncleanness. Therefore, do not give your daughters to their sons, neither take their daughters for your sons, and never seek their peace or prosperity, that you may be strong and eat of the good land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. So he says, he speaks of the commandments of the prophets. He doesn't mean that this is an exact quote from any of the prophets, but this was the general tenor of their teaching, and not only that, but the law itself plainly stated that they were not to intermarry with the peoples of the lands. And then he said, never seek their peace or prosperity. The exact prohibition from the law was, don't make a covenant with them. Don't make a covenant with the people of the land of any kind. And of course, a marriage would indeed be a covenant. This, the equivalent to this in the New Testament would be what? We're to what? Keep ourselves from, be not unequally yoked with the unbeliever, would be perhaps the New Testament equivalent to that. Any question or comment so far? Okay. And after all that has come upon us, for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, seeing that you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserved and have given us such a remnant as this, shall we break your commandments again and intermarry with the people who practice these abominations? Would you not be angry with us until you consumed us so that there should be no remnant nor any escape? It seems to me that he's saying, look, God has tried severity. He's tried goodness. Because of our sins, he brought an end to our nation, sent us into captivity. And now he's brought at least a remnant back to our... So he's been severe, he's been kind, and look, we still are doing we've always done. If God's severity nor his goodness makes a difference, what is he left to do? What is left for God to do? Perhaps Ezra thought that only thing left would be just complete annihilation. And so he says, O Lord, our God, the God of Israel, you are just, for we are left a remnant that has escaped. As it is today, behold, we are before you in our guilt, for none can stand before you because of this. We don't have anything to plead in our case. We can't plead ignorance, because your word made it clear that we're not to intermarry with these people. We stand before you guilty and hopeful that your loving kindness will be shown to us again. Any comment about this? All right. Let's move on to chapter 10. While Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, a very great assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him out of Israel, for the people wept bitterly. So Ezra was distressed, and as others saw his distress, they too became distressed, and they gathered round him in support of him. And one named, verse 2, and Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, of the sons of Elam, addressed Ezra. And here's what he said. We have broken faith with our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land, but even now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. Therefore, verse 3, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all these wives and their children according to the counsel of my Lord, and for those who have and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to His law. This individual, Shechaniah, makes this recommendation. We've done wrong, we've sinned, but there's still hope for us. So let's put away, let's make a covenant, let's all agree together that we're going to stop this and we're going to make amends. And he says we're going to put away these wives and their children. Notice the last expression, according to the law. The Old Testament, of course, was familiar with the divorce. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 and 2. You remember Jesus tells us in Matthew 19 that God permitted divorce in the Old Testament, not because it was His original plan for marriage. In fact, it was very much contrary to it, but because of the hardness of their heart, He permitted it to be so. And so the law provided a means by which a woman who was put away by her husband for frivolous reasons could then be considered eligible for remarriage again. And so, in fact, a lot of the scribes interpreted that to mean that a man could put away his wife for almost any cause whatsoever. And so, from a legal standpoint, there was no problem with this, and Ezra could see that. And although I'm sure he hated that they had to go to something like this, because it's always a serious thing when families break up, but still, in the whole picture, it was the right thing to do. And so, the recommendation is that we, according to the law, that we write a bill of divorcement. Let's find out who it is indeed that has married these women, and let's write a bill of divorcement for them, set those women free with their children so that they can remarry, and then let's move on and not do this anymore. And look at verse 6. He said, arise. He's talking to Ezra. Arise, for it is your task, and we are with you. Be strong and do it. In my notes I've written in my Bible, sometimes ministers need to be encouraged as well. The encourager sometimes needs to be encouraged. And so they're saying to Ezra, get up. Get up. You're upset. We're all upset, but that we need to remedy this. It's your job to lead us in this. And we will be with you and we will assist you in this matter. And so verse 5, then Ezra arose and made the leading priest and Levites and all Israel take an oath that they would do as had been said. So they took an oath. Ezra probably did this while it was still fresh on everybody's mind, so that they couldn't. An oath was a serious thing, and so he said, "Let's get them to take an oath to this." And that's before people change their mind. And so they did. And then in verse 6, Ezra withdrew from before the house of God and went into the chamber of Jehohanan, the son of Eliashib, where he spent the night, neither eating bread nor drinking water, for he was mourning over the faithlessness of the exiles. He was very much disturbed about this. He knew it was a very serious matter, that these people were on the verge of losing their identity. If they continued this and it spread throughout the community, then the time would come when they would be lost as a people. And so he spent the night. The temple, when Solomon built the temple, it had, the tabernacle didn't, but the temple had these rooms on the outside, on either side of the temple. And so apparently they were building the same, they did the same thing in rebuilding it. And one of these chambers belonged to or was assigned to Jehohanan, the son of Eliashib, who under Nehemiah, that we're going to be studying next, became high priest. And he was given permission to use that chamber. And he went in there and fasted and no doubt prayed through the night, seeking God's guidance and wisdom in all of this. In verse 7, "And a proclamation was made throughout Judah and Jerusalem to all the returned exiles that they should assemble in Jerusalem, and that if anyone did not come within 3 days by order of the officials, the elders, all his property should be forfeited, and he himself banned from the congregation of the exiles." So they were asked to come into Jerusalem, and I guess at first they thought they would begin to the process of ferreting out who it was that was married to these women and seeking to get rid of them. Then in verse 9, all the men of Judah and Jerusalem assembled in all the men of Judah and Benjamin assembled in Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the 9th month on the 20th day of the month, and all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and because of the heavy rain. The 9th month on the Jewish calendar would be roughly equivalent to our month of December. And the climate in Palestine was not too much different from that here in our part of the world. So December was often a rainy, cold time of the year. When was it? Was it one day last week that it was raining, and it wasn't just bitterly cold, but in that rainy atmosphere, it was cold and very much uncomfortable. And so they were brought together, and here they were in the middle of what would be to us December, standing or sitting in the rain. As if the place where they were gathered was a court that was about roughly about the length of 2 football fields and the width, 3 times the width of a football field. So there would be plenty of room for all the men. When you take away the, you remember only 50,000 had returned with Zerubbabel and another 1,700 or 1,800 with Ezra. When you take out the aged who could not make the trip, the infirm, the sick, the boys below 12 years of age, then you're looking, I don't know, 10, 12, 14,000, 15,000 people, and that area would have been plenty of room for that number of people together, which they did. But someone made the suggestion. Ezra stood up and said, "You have broken faith with and married foreign women and so increased the guilt of Israel. Now then, make confession to the Lord, the God of your fathers, and do His will. Separate yourselves from these people of the land and from the foreign wives." And the assembly, then all the assembly answered with a loud voice, "It is so. We must do as you have said. But the people are many, and it's time. And it is a time of heavy rain, and we cannot stand in the open. Nor is it a task for one today, or for 1 or 2 days. So, for we have greatly transgressed." So, look at verse 14. "Let our officials stand for the whole assembly. Let us all in our cities who have taken foreign wives come at appointed times, and with them the elders and judges of every city, until the fierce wrath of God over this matter is turned away." And so they said, look, this is not a way to handle this. And, you know, Ezra was strong in a lot of ways, but he one of the strengths, though, of Ezra was he would take a suggestion when it was a good one. And he recognized, apparently, the wisdom of this decision. And so rather than dealing with all this crowd and this weather and so forth, the decision was made. Ezra would appoint a committee, a standing committee. And I think we'll learn in just a few minutes that what he did, he probably appointed someone from each of the families that had returned. Someone has suggested it was probably less than 100, and so he appointed a standing committee, and then people from the various communities would come in smaller groups along with the elders and judges from their community, and they would sit down with this group and look into all of this. First of all, they would be trying to make sure that find out who it was that actually had married one of these foreigners. And some of them might have married someone who had become a proselyte, who was converting, as it were, to Judaism. And so you'd have to make sure about cases like that. And so it took, there would be those from the community who knew these people, and they would be able to determine the truth about the matter. So, and look at verse 15. Only Jonathan, the son of Asahel, and Josiah, the son of Tikva, opposed this, and Meshullam and Shabbethai, the Levite, supported them. In other words, there were a few, and you would expect this, wouldn't you? There was a few that didn't go along with this necessarily. But it was only a few, and not only that, they did not deter them, because they went right on with their plan as they had projected. And in verse 16, then the returned exiles did so. Ezra the priest selected men, heads of fathers' houses, according to their fathers' houses, each of them designated by name. That means that he selected people. He made a list of those whom he had selected. He chose not to give that to us, but there was a list, and Ezra had it in his possession. On the first day of the 10th month, they sat down to examine the matter. So between the 20th day of the 9th month and the first day of the 10th month, all these arrangements were made. And on the first day of the 10th month, these people began to come in small groups, and they began to examine this meeting, this matter. And by the first day of the first month, they had come to the end of all the men who had married foreign women. So in 3 months, from the first day of the 10th month to the first day of the first month, in 3 months, they had concluded the matter. Now, now there were found some of the sons. He's going to list now. And I think it's important that he did. This was a serious matter. And he wanted there to be a record of those who were involved in this. First of all, for themselves. This was part of their punishment, as it were. Their names are being recorded, those who had violated God's law here. And then also for future use as well. Now there were found some of the sons of the priest who had married foreign women. And he mentions them, Maaseiah, Eleazar, Jarib, and Gedaliah. Some of the sons of Jeshua, the son of Josedech, and his brothers. There were 113. If we read this list carefully and count them, you'll see there were 113 who were eventually determined. I guess I'm going to have to start using that ear thing. There were 113 that were guilty of this. Four of them were from the high priest, families of the high priest. That's the four names that we just read in verse 18. They were members of families of the high priest, four of them. And then there were 13 others from other priestly families. In other words, priests who were not high priests. There were 13 from those families. And then there were 10 Levites. Now remember, we've talked about this a lot. All priests were Levites, but not all Levites were priests. So you had high priests, you had other priests, and then you had Levites, those who assisted the priest in their work. Four from high priest families, 13 from other priestly families, and 10 from families of the Levites. And then, where is it in verse, and by the way, if you want to read those names from verses 20 to 24, you'll see the 10 and the 13. But then in verse 25, and of Israel. So that means the lay people, so to speak, those who were not of the ecclesiastical families. And so the names of all these people are listed. And in the verse 44, all these had married foreign women, and some of the women had even born children. This adds a human element to it. This was not a simple matter. This was not an easy matter. It was a serious matter. And the breaking up of a home is always a serious matter. And even though these marriages had been formed in violation to God's will, the putting aside of these wives and their children, and the Ezra doesn't go into all the details that were involved, and all kinds of questions that we all would have about it. Were provisions made for them? Well, you know, there were. Abraham, you know, but when he put away Ishmael and his mother, he made provisions for them and so forth. But it had to be done in the interest of the preserving the purity of the chosen race. Any questions or comments about this? We're going to quit just a little bit earlier because I'm struggling with the sinus problems anyway, and I got to speak again here in a few minutes. Yes. Yeah.
The seriousness of his confession and praying.
Right.
And the people had to separate themselves. You wonder, of those that were separated, some of them had children, and how they handled that.
Yeah.
I don't think they just turned them loose a little bit.
That's exactly right. And all these questions we have, and doesn't it make you wish that, doesn't it make you recognize the importance of good, strong leaders. And as Brother Brownon said, they began to go astray here, and Ezra steps in. This is not an easy matter. You'd be tempted to just kind of turn your head to it, because after all, someone might say, it was only 113 out of thousands. But Ezra didn't turn his head to it, did he? He stepped in and took the matter in hand. Any other questions or comments? Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. He saw that they were taking care of. He could have just said, move on, my wife, I'm a Christian now. That's a hard thing.
It's easy for us to talk about it, isn't it? But you just think about how difficult. When you told that story, it reminded me of the summer I spent in Nigeria with Brother Jim Massey in 66. A very similar a story I have. My interpreter was a man named Moses Apara. Moses had been a Juju priest. Jim Massey had converted him. And like you say, he had had several wives, as many of them in that country did have. And Brother Massey, when he was talking him through this and studying the scripture with him, told him that now you'll need to take your original wife, but he did a similar thing. He put the others away, and made provisions for the ones that he put away. Well, she was just saying essentially what I just said, that when they were in Africa, that one of the people they knew there, had multiple wives, and he chose, after becoming a Christian, to put away those wives, and have only his first wife. All right. Well, we'll begin next Sunday, and in the last month, we'll look at Nehemiah. There are 14 chapters, so we won't be able to take it verse by verse. We'll probably just have to kind of summarize a few chapters each week. But by the way, one of the things you'll learn is that just a few years after this that we've just read about, it raises its head again. It raises its head again, and Nehemiah has to deal with it again, just like Ezra did. Thank you.